Hi, it's an honor to be here. You guys have Tanachim, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, somewhere between the tea and the cookies. I'd like to take a look this morning at the phenomenon of surprise in Tanakh. And there's a very definite pedagogic reason for doing that. We suffer from a handicap in learning that is a little bit of a surprising one. We're familiar with the regular handicaps. We don't understand the language, we don't understand the reality, the background, etc. We suffer also from an unusual handicap, which is we know too much. I'll give you a minute to recover from that statement, because you don't usually hear teachers telling you you're too wise. But we know too much, meaning we know how stories play out, and so we know what the end is before we start reading the beginning. We know something else. We also know what every character has said to each other or what every character is thinking, as long as we've been given privy to it, but that doesn't mean that all the other characters in the story are familiar that way. And that means we have a leg up over them, but it means it's a handicap. Because as we're reading the story, we're not sufficiently sensitive to what's really going on, what the expectations are, and therefore what the irony is, what the surprise is, and we may even be confused by certain reactions that happen, and I have to come up with all sorts of explanations for them. And if we were to read the story straight, it would become quite clear. I'll point your attention immediately to Perek Chaf Dalet, which in the chapter divisions that we're stuck with, they're not ours, is the longest chapter in Bereshit. What is the subject of Perek Chaf Dalet? What is Perek Chaf Dalet about? It's about one topic. Perek Chaf Dalet. One topic. Perek Chaf Dalet. What? What about Rivka?
Getting
a wife for Yitzchak. That's the topic. It starts with Avraham administering an oath to his Eved, and ends with Yitzchak, the last pasuk. Yitzchak marries Rivka, and he's comforted. What happens? I want to point your attention to begin to something at the end. Take a look at pasuk Samach Dalet and Samach Chet. Rivka is returning with the Eved, and we're going to come back to that title. And we see the following. So Yitzchak, who is now coming from Be'er Lachayroi, and Rivka comes with the Eved and with the Eved's men and with all the camels and all of her girls. They're all coming together. She sees Yitzchak, and the first thing she does is she falls off the camel. Or she gets off the camel. Unclear why. What does she ask the Eved? Who's that guy? Now, what, does she ask him about every guy they pass? Who's that guy? What does the Eved say? That's my master. Which, by the way, itself is a little bit curious, because at the beginning of the parakut was his master, Avram. So something shifted there. She then takes her shawl or whatever it is, and she covers herself up. And then the Eved tells Yitzchak everything that's happened. Yitzchak takes Rivka in. What's with all this falling off the camel? What's all this asking questions? We're not clear. So we come up with explanations about why she fell off the camel, but if we read the story straight through with open eyes, you might see something else going on that would explain it. Klal Gadol. An important rule in studying Tanakh. The truth is, in studying any narrative, but in Tanakh it's doubly important. Anything that's important in studying literature becomes doubly important in studying Tanakh, because Tanakh is also literature, but it's literature that's Kodesh. And therefore, we're that much more called to understand it correctly and understand it with all the multiplicity of approaches possible. We cannot properly understand Tanakh unless we put ourselves into the story as each character individually and as a fly on the wall. You know what a fly on the wall is, right? So he's there but not there. Meaning I'm watching the events take place in front of me and I'm seeing what's happening. I'm watching Shimon and Levi massacre the town. which makes me step back and say, well, how old do we think they really are? This leads to a lot of other questions about the chronology in Bereshit. All right, I'm looking at Yaakov and Lavan negotiating Har Gilad. I'm trying to see the scene. But besides that, I also have to be Yaakov in that scene, be Lavan in that scene, be Rachel in that scene, and try to see from their point of view, what is it they know, what is it they don't know, what are they keeping secret, what is being kept in secret from them, and try to gauge what's going on. Okay. So I'm going to start out with an example from something much later, which is a very famous article written by Rav Yoel Ben Nun almost 30 years ago, I think, or maybe more than 30 years ago, which was the very first article in the first issue of a journal called Megadim about Tanakh, which to this day raises lots of passions and ire in the Beit Midrash, which is good, because that kind of Mechamta Shel Torah is always a good thing. He asked the question about what it was that Yosef was doing throughout his entire, this is the second half of Bereshit, throughout the entire dealing with his brothers. He looks to be very mean. He looks to be being mean to his father. His behavior with his brothers is very bizarre. When his brothers show up in Mitzrayim, instead of brothers, instead he plays this game. What's going on? So all of Rishonim address the problem. And part of the problem starts out with the first pasuk that appears, which is Vayizkor Yosef et haChalomot. When Yosef sees his brothers, the first thing he does is he thinks about the dreams that he had, and then he immediately launches into a strategy. So where's that coming from? So Ben Nun suggests that the question that's asked by the Rishonim, which is, why didn't Yosef, as soon as he was in a position to do so, send a message to his father saying, "Father, I'm okay"? Because what do we know is happening? Father thinks he's dead. Father's mourning. Father goes through over 20 years of being absolutely bereft. And in the meantime, Yosef's not only okay, he's doing fine. He's doing very well. Even when he was in Potiphar's house, but certainly when he became viceroy of Egypt, he's in a position to send a message to Yaakov, "I'm okay, don't worry." He doesn't do so. So everybody asks that question and then uses that as sort of the opening to understanding Yosef's behavior with his brothers. So Rabbi Nun says, let's turn the question inside out. If you're Yosef, from your perspective, you could ask the opposite question, which is, my father, who loves me, sent me out on a journey to go visit my brothers. He knew my brothers didn't like me. I was taken as a slave. I was sold into slavery. And father has not been looking for me. How come father's not looking for me? And reasonably, and I'm not going to belabor this because it's not the main focus here, but just as a starting off point, Yosef, looking from his perspective, what he knows, could come to a very different conclusion than that which we know looking at it panoramically from above. Let's think about what Yosef thinks has gone on from his perspective. Yosef knows that he comes from a family in which the last two generations have seen what happened. What happened in Avraham's household? There were two main kids, and what happened? One was sent away, and the other one inherits. Grandfather, Yitzchak, had two kids, Abba and Uncle Esav. How would you like one of those? Right? And what happened with them? Esav was given what he was given, and Yaakov, which means we come from a family where somehow, as part of this process, there's a winnowing out. Now, I'm Yosef. I've got all these brothers. Father definitely has favored me, but there's a lot of anger in the family. Father's aware of it. And what's the next thing I know? Father sends me on a ridiculous mission. My brothers are all up in Shechem. I'm in Hebron. My brother's up in Shechem grazing. Father sends me up, see how they're doing. The next thing I know, what do I know? I don't know what their discussions are. What do I know has happened? Next thing? They throw me in a pit, take off the garment, throw me in a pit. I don't know that the garment has been stained with blood later. I'm thrown in a pit. What's the next thing I know has happened? Money's changing hands. I'm being dragged down to the pit. I'm being sold as a slave. I go to Mitzrayim. Parenthetically, let's think back two generations. What happened when Avraham's older son was sent out? How old was he? Yeah, how old was Ishmael when he got sent out?
13.
About 17, right? Because how old was Ishmael when Yitzchak was born? 14. And Yitzchak was at the weaning party, which is about 3 years old. So Ishmael's about 17. Ishmael gets sent out to the desert, ends up almost dying, ends up getting rescued, and ends up in Egypt marrying an Egyptian woman. Gee, sounds a lot like Yosef. Interesting, by the way, who brought Yosef down to Mitzrayim? Yishmaelim. So there's a circle that closes. Okay, so Yosef comes down to Mitzrayim, and he's doing well there. Just like Esav did well in Edom, and just like Yishmael did well in Paran, Mibar Paran. So maybe that's my job. Maybe the reason Father's not looking for me is that Father was complicit in the whole deal. He doesn't know that he almost got killed by the brothers. He doesn't know that. So Yosef's in Mitzrayim, the brothers come down, playing the game. When he starts to see cracks in the story is with the whole issue of Binyamin, and finally when Yehuda says, in that plea for Binyamin, that Father's been mourning for Yosef the whole time, that's when everything opens up. So again, if you look at it from each person's point of view, you can understand what's happening a lot better. Okay, so rolling back to our story. Let's start with this. You're Rivka. Okay? You're Rivka. Let's take one step back. From the beginning of the parak, who are the two characters that are speaking? At the beginning of the parak, Avdali. Avraham and? Okay, so now I'm going to go back to that point. You're calling him Eliezer. Why are you calling him Eliezer? What? Why are you assuming this? Okay, good. Where is Eliezer ever called Eved Avraham? So let's take a look and see if this could be Eliezer. All right. And we're going to see a couple things in Havdalah that will indicate not. Take a look back at the one place that we meet Eliezer by name. Anybody know where it is? Perek Tedvav. Good. Perek Tedvav. Okay? So in Perek Tedvav, after the war with the kings, Hashem comes to Avraham. And we assume that this is when Avraham's about 70 or so. That's how we play with the numbers. Right? That Hashem says to Avraham, Schachar b'miod. And what does Avraham say? What's the point of giving me a sachar? I got no kids. Uven meshek beiti huda mesek Eliezer. What does ben meshek beiti mean? The guy who's in charge of my household, my CFO. Avram's a wealthy man. He's got shepherds, he's got holdings, and he's got a guy who's in charge of the accounts. That's Eliezer. Eliezer's from Damascus. Eliezer's not called an Eved here. He's a ben meshek. By the way, this is when Avram's about 70, and Eliezer's already old enough to be in charge of his household. How old is Avram at the scene where he sends to get a wife for Yitzchak? Well, we know it's after Sarah died, right? So it changes. So at least 137.
Right.
So it's 137. How long has passed since we identified a fellow named Eliezer as being the head of his household?
67
years. All right. So let's step back a second and ask a different question. Avraham wants to get a wife for Yitzchak. Doesn't want to get a local girl. Sends to Haran. Why doesn't Avraham go himself?
He's too old.
Matter of fact, not only is he too old, but what does Avraham think is about to happen? Look at Pasuk Aleph. He's about to die. How do I know Avraham thinks he's about to die? Because what does Avraham make the slave, who's never given a name in this story? What does he do? What does he do as part of the oath? So let's take a look, please, in Pasuk Pasuk Bes. What does Avraham tell the slave to do? Put your hand under my thigh. I'm going to take an oath. I'll make you take an oath. What's the oath? That you will not get a wife for Yitzchak from a local girl. Rather, you'll go back to my family. And the other part of the oath is that you won't have Yitzchak leave, but she'll come here. But what's it with the thigh? What's that about? Is there any other place in Tanakh that you know of where somebody makes somebody else take an oath and puts the man taking the oath, puts his hand under the thigh of the guy administering the oath? Any other place? So keep your hand on Chavdala. Please move ahead to Perek Mem Chet. Sorry, just before Mem Chet, the end of Mem Zayin. All right? Pasuk Chavtet. What do you see there? What do you see at the end of Perek Mem Zayin in Bereshit? Yaakov is on his deathbed, or he thinks he's on his deathbed, and he has Yosef put his hands under Yaakov's thigh and take an oath to what? He won't bury him in Egypt. Rather, he'll take him back to Marat HaLach Pelat of Arian. So what's with the thigh? So in the ancient world, when somebody took an oath this way, where I would put my hands under your body, you'd be sitting on me, it was symbolic of the idea that you are fully dependent on me. It's like you're sitting on me. You're fully relying on me. Why is Yaakov fully relying on Yosef? Because where you bury me, I can't control. I can't stop in the middle of it and say, no, time out, I want to be buried there. I'm dead already. So I'm fully relying on you. Go back to Avraham. How does the whole parsha start? Avraham zaken, ba bayamim. What does that phrase mean, ba bayamim? It's about to die. Now, it turns out he lives a lot longer. But that's the impression we have. So Avraham thinks he's about to die. Therefore, he can't go get a wife. He says, you go get a wife. I don't think I'm going to be here when she comes back. And I'm therefore making you take an oath because I won't be around to control it. And I'm putting this oath on you with all of the power of the afterlife, as it were, with the thigh. And we know what the oath is. Now, is it likely that this fellow who's called an Eved and never has a name is the same fellow who 67 years ago was already the CFO of Avraham's holdings? So why do we say Eliezer Ben Avraham? Because Chazal call him Eliezer Ben Avraham. Where do Chazal say this? Where do Chazal ever refer to Eliezer Ben Avraham? So there's a famous, there's in Midrashim, there's a famous passage in Masachet Chulin which talks about Nichush, meaning using signs to determine what you're going to do. Kol Nichush, she'enon ki Nichush, Yonatan ben Shaul ulecha Eliezer Ben Avraham eino nichush. Big machlok and Rambam Rav about what that means. Okay, whether it means that's defined as a nichush and therefore you're chayav, or that's a nichush you should rely on. But what's the thing where he said, "I'm going to be out here. Whatever girl comes out to give me water, etc." That's the girl. She's called Eliezer Ben Avraham. Why is that? Well, there's two possible reasons. One is because we have no other name for anybody else in Avraham's household. On Ereshkol and Mamre were not members of Avraham's household. They were treaty partners. So we borrow the name Eliezer. Another possibility is something interesting to think about. What kind of language is Eliezer? What language is Eliezer? The name Eliezer? It's Hebrew. Eliezer. My God helps. Where is Eliezer from?
Syria,
which means what language should it be in? Aramaic. Arami. He's from Aram. So it should be Arami. Why is his name Ivri? Because maybe Avraham gave him that name. So it's certainly possible that maybe the most important guy in Avraham's household gets a nickname, Eliezer. Remember this throughout Tanakh. Who's Avimelech? Melech Plishtim. Which generation? Every generation. It's always called Avimelech. So it could be Eliezer is like the name for Eved Avraham. Right. Either way, this guy is told to go and find a wife for Yitzhak. Okay. Now this guy is an important guy. Yeah.
It's from a textual thing. It says
so that's a similarity. So correct. But again, we have a problem of close to 7 decades, right?
Zekan Beto, it says.
And it's Zekan Beto, which may mean, or it may mean he's like the eldest statesman among the Avadim. But he's still got to be young enough to make this journey, which is a good 800 miles in each direction, and to lead a caravan. That's quite a job, right? So again, if it is Eliezer, it doesn't bother me. But it just would be hard to understand why Avraham's not making the journey, but asking this old slave to do it, this old CFO to do it. In any case, Avraham administers the oath. The Eved knows that he's going in order to get a wife for Yitzchak. He goes, and what does he look like? He's a worn traveler, right? But he's a traveler who's got 10 camels, a lot of gold. And what does he come to? So let's take a look at Pasuk Yod. Right? He comes to the city of Nahor, a family. So he gets to the outskirts of the city, outside of the city, where there are the Be'erot, the wells where they draw water. And it's at the end of the day when the young girls come out to draw water. That would have evidently custom. See, throughout Tanakh, it was part of the job of the young girls to draw the water, and the girls are going to come out. Okay. And then he has his tefillah. Now, what happens when he says his tefillah? Say, please bring a girl for my master. By the way, take a look in Pasuk Yudbet. Asechesed im Adoni Avraham, I'm my master Avraham. Okay, and in Pasuk Yodal, Vayana Rasha Marla, Hatina Chadech Veshtev, Amra Shtev, Gam Gomecha Ashke, he Aisha, he Otam Chachtal of the Chali Yitzchak, Vaydaki Asita Chesedim Adonai. So it's very clear to us, we understand what he's doing. He's getting a wife for Yitzchak. Very good. All right. Vayuterim Kilal Daber. Now I want you to be Rivka for a minute. Okay, parenthetically, how old is Rivka at this point? Good. So what? Okay, so Rashi quotes Seder Olam. Seder Olam, as you may know, is the second century Midrash that creates a chronology of events in Tanakh, how old people were and what years things happened. And there is one manuscript that actually says Rivka was 3 and that Yitzchak was 37 at the time of the Akedah, and the Akedah happens at this time, and therefore when Yitzchak, we know, is 40 when he marries Rivka, she's 3 at the time. But almost all the other manuscripts actually have 14. And Yitzchak was 26 at the Akedah. A lot more mistaber in this story to say she's 14 for several reasons. First of all, nobody got married at the age of 3 in the ancient world. People got betrothed day one. But Mary, that was around puberty, around 12, 13. All right? Second of all, in the middle of the story, they ask Rivka, do you want to go with him? You can ask a 3-year-old about a life decision, and whatever she says, that goes. It's a little bit strange. 14, and again, almost all the good manuscripts of Seder Olam have 14. And the Rishonim, who look at it independently, seem to agree that she is about that age. Okay, now, she comes out. Va'naratovat marem yod, etc. And look at Yud Zayin. Va'yarotzev adikrata va'yomar aminin amarayim mikadech. Again, he's called Ha'eved. Va'tomer shtei aduni. What does she say to him? Drink, my master. So, what does she not necessarily know about him that we know? That he's an Eved. Right? A guy comes and she has him drink, and then of course she finishes, and then she on her own offers to feed the camels. Here's a guy coming with a bunch of camels. He looks pretty important. Shtei aduni. Alright, and now continue. Pasuk chafalefa ish mishta'ela. What's he not called in this pasuk? Ish. He's watching her to see what's going to happen. What does he take? A gold ring. And 2 bracelets. Serious stuff. But notice he's called Aish. Bat Miat, whose daughter Ruth, a place for us to stay. She identifies who she is, etc. And he immediately, the man prays, bows, and thanks God. All right? Good. Now, what does he say in his tefillah? You've done chesed for my master Abraham, etc. But we're not privy to his tefillah. Rivka's not privy to his tefillah. In the meantime, what's she done? She has run back home. And she's told people what? She's told people that there's this wealthy guy who's come, and I gave him water, and I fed the camels, and immediately he asked about the family, and he put all this jewelry on me, or in the opposite order. Put all this jewelry on me. Okay? Let's invite him in. Look at Pasuk Lamed. Ko diber elai ha'ish. Now, he comes in and they put food down and they say, tell your story, have some food. He says, I won't eat anything until I tell my story. They say, okay, talk. Who's in the room with him? Lavan and Betuel. We don't hear about Rivka's mother, and we certainly don't hear about Rivka being there. We know Rivka's not there, because what happens at the end of the conversation when he says, I want to go?
Let's call Rivka.
They say, let's call Rivka in and ask her if she wants to go. So he tells this whole story, etc., etc., and tells all the story, including the oath, including why he's here, and very famously modifies some parts of what happened, and parts of even what Avraham adjured him. Rashi picks up on those differences. He turns out to be a brilliant strategist and negotiator in what he changes. It's all good. Rivka's not there. And he says that, I want to take her, and let's move ahead and see what happens when Rivka comes in. Start with Nun. Which means Laban told very clear, you're coming to represent the son of your master. Okay, good. Where's Rivka in the meantime? Not in the room. And then he by Tseha Eved, Klechez Mechlezav Gadim. Okay, now. Say, let her stay for a year or 10 months. What does the guy say? Send me so I can go back to my master. Again, they're sitting there with Lavanim Tuel. Let's go call Rivka and ask her. What did they say? Will you go with this ish? Now it looks like we're belaboring a point here about whether he's called ish or evident, who's in the room. But again, critical. I want you to think about how this story plays out from the POV, point of view of Rivka. Up until this point, what has Rivka seen? She was out drawing water. An important man came with a lot of camels. He looked like an important guy, and she gave him water. She gave water to the camels, immediately gave her all this jewelry and asked about the family. Right? He comes in, and the family sits down, and he tells whatever his story is. I'm outside doing whatever I'm doing. And then there's some big celebration, and they're eating, and then they call me in, and what do they ask me? Hatelchi im ha'ish hazeh. What are they asking her?
This man.
Right. So what does Rivka think?
That this is the guy.
Right. Now, this guy's old. I don't care. Eliezer, not Eliezer, this guy's old. He's Kan Beitel. His Kan Beitel doesn't mean after the geezer. He could have all his teeth, but he's not a kid. And she's all of 14 at most, right? That's not unusual at all in the ancient world to have a guy who's in his 50s, 60s, whatever, to be marrying a girl at that age. It's just not weird. So it's not as if he's going to say, well, that's Cam and the guy. He's old enough to be my grandfather. That's mine. Right? That's not going to get in the way. So now, watch how it plays out. From their perspective, where are they sending? Rivka and her nursemaid. Her nursemaid doesn't mean she's nursing. It means a woman to nurse her babies. And Eved Avraham, by Rachud Rivka, Vemulah, Chotin Ataiil Ofir, Vemulah, Yishal Zoret, Chariva, the Gurun, Ice Bracha, Atav Rivka, and Atav Tzirkam, Nalak Malim, Tilachna, Achare, Haish. So who do they follow? Haish. By Kacha, Eved Rivka, Vayelach. What do we know? It's an Eved. Who's she following? An Ish. Okay? Yitzchak, Bomi, Bami, Bom, Be'er Lacharoi, where Yishay, Be'er Tanegel. In the meantime, Yitzchak is coming from Be'er Lacharoi. Yitzchak looks up and sees the camels. So we've got the Navatarit Yitzchak, but she sees Yitzchak. So what does she perhaps suddenly realize? Because she sees Yitzchak, but who else is she looking at? She's probably looking at the Ish that she thinks she's going to marry. And she evidently sees some recognition in him. Says, who is that guy? Watch this. Vatomer El Ha'eved Mi Ha'ish. What does she suddenly realize? I'm not marrying him. Maybe I marry him. Somebody saying why she fell off the camel? Everything suddenly has changed. And notice how cleverly the text uses Ish and Eved to describe the same person, depending who's there and who's looking at it. From their perspective, they know the whole time it's an Eved. From Abraham's time, the whole perspective, the whole time it's an Eved. From the text perspective, it's an Eved. And from her perspective, it's an Ish. Until this point, Vatomer el ha'eved mi ha'ish. It says, who Adoni? Surprise. But by following the story from Rivka's perspective, suddenly we understand the events as they unfold, and we can also decipher the alternating uses of the two terms to describe it. So what happens? Vayim ha'eved hu Adoni, v'atikach ha'tzei v'atikas, and now by Yisaper ha'eved li'Yitzchak, you call it v'ma sh'rasah, and then Yitzchak takes her and is very happy, etc. She's fortunate because it's not the guy that she thought she was going to marry. Parenthetically, within the story, there's another piece of the puzzle that perhaps you want to investigate. Before I want to move ahead to the next week's parasha, show you another little bit of perhaps a surprise. How did the parasha begin? Parashat Chayei Sarah. How does it start? Why Chayei Sarah? Parenthetically, it's total parentheses. Why are we told about Sarah's death? Why are we told about Sarah's death? There's only one reason we're told about Sarah's death, and if you look at the story, you'll see that most of the story is not about Sarah's death. What's it about? Kinyan Marat Machpelah. Sarah's death is important chiefly because it is the keyhole through which Abraham opens the door to finally acquiring land. 60 plus years ago, Hashem told him, Lech Lecha, and I'm going to give you this land. And he hasn't gotten one dunam yet. And now finally, when Sarah passes, finally, that's when he gets his first acquisition. That's why he's so insistent on not taking it as a gift, but acquiring it. And he gets land. Where is Abraham living? So he's living in Hebron. Right? So in Hebron. So you're saying, why did he say by Abraham? That's what you're going to ask. Yeah, you think by Shabbat. So let's take a look at it. Well, where is Abraham living throughout the time when he is raising his family? When he's doing his work of trying to establish himself in the land. He's living in Hebron. Kiryat Arba in Hebron. He's in Hebron. What happened after the Akedah? It's a very surprising thing. Where is Yitzchak at the end of the Akedah? Where is he?
Nowhere.
Looks like he's nowhere. But it's a little bit difficult to think he's nowhere. Let me show you something at the end of the Akedah, which is going to take us to Chayei Sarah and move us ahead. The very end of the Akedah, last pasuk is Vayashav Avram al Na'arav Vayakum Yechul Yechtav Bershava Yeshiv Avram Bibershava. Who are Na'arav? We think the two guys who accompanied him, right? The two kids who accompanied Abraham and Yitzchak to the Akedah. You're going to wonder, where's Yitzchak? Time out. Time out. Look ahead, look above. Pasuk Hey. Vayu Avraham Na'arav, Shulachem Poy Machamor, Vani, Vehanar Nachadko. How many Na'arim are there in this story?
Three.
There's the two who accompany Avram, and there's Yitzchak who's around. Now, what happened up on the Akedah? Up at the Mizbeach. Avram puts Yitzchak on the Mizbeach. I get very nervous about this. My name is Yitzchak. Avram puts Yitzchak up on the Mizbeach. He's tied the whole thing. Avram's like this, with the knife up. Malach says, stop. What happens at that point? There's a ram. What does Avram now do? So we forget because it doesn't say in the text. Again, be there, look at it, and see what happens. There's a single mizbeach. There's a fire going to go on the mizbeach. So please tell me what happens to Yitzchak.
Take him off.
He unties him and takes him off. Where does Yitzchak go? Yitzchak goes to a distance, not far away, but distance to watch. What does Avram do? Avram takes the aisle and offers it in place of Yitzchak. Vayashav Avraham el Na'arav. Who does he go back to? Yitzchak and the other two, and they all go back to Beersheba. Because the next time we meet Yitzchak, where is he living? In Beersheba. When Rivka comes, where is he coming from? Be'er Lachai Ro'i, which is outside of Beersheba. Yitzchak's living in Beersheba. Where did Avram go back to? After Beersheba, he then goes to Hebron. He's living in Hebron. Now what happens in Hebron? He calls his Eved after Sarah is buried. And Yitzchak is not at the burial. Yitzchak's not at the negotiations. Yitzchak's not there when Sarah dies, right? He's missing from that story. Why? Because he's in Beersheba. We'll talk about why in a second. Avraham is in Hebron. He calls his slave, who keeps identifying himself as Eved Avraham, and he tells him, take a wife, et cetera, right? Where does the slave take the girl to? Not to Hebron, to Beersheba. To whom? And by the way, where's Avram at the wedding? Avram's not mentioned here. Avram's not mentioned anymore at all in this context. After the whole story, we hear Avram lived, then Avram died, and Avram was buried by Yitzchak and Ishmael. But we don't have Avram involved in Yitzchak's life anymore. Because where's Avram? Avram's in Chevron. Yitzchak's in Beersheba. By the way, what happened to the Eved? What happened to the Eved? So let's circle back for a second. Who did Rivka take with her when she went to bury, when she left? She didn't leave alone.
The nursemaid.
Na'arotah. Who are they? They're servants, right? Who do they belong to? They belong to her family. Now who do they belong to? They belong to her. There's something in common. You read in Masachet Tubot, Avadim, they come along with a marriage. Who's this guy? Eved Avraham. By the end of the story, who is he? Eved Yitzchak. How does he identify Yitzchak when he gets there? Who? Adoni. He's my master, not Ben Adoni. So evidently, what the understanding was is you're going to go, you're going to find a wife for Yitzchak, and then you're going to come and you're going to become Yitzchak's servant as part of this process. It says, who Adoni? Well, because we don't hear about this Eved going or staying or anything more. We're just kind of extrapolating from what we got. So now let's roll back and ask the question, why is it that Yitzchak's living in Beersheba if Avram's living in Hebron? They're two very different cities. And again, we got to put ourselves back in the position of the time to figure out what's going on.
Was he angry that his father was going to sacrifice him?
So there's lots of midrashic information. By the way, the best place to read this is Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling about Kierkegaard's Fear book, Fear and Trembling, about the Akedah. It talks about the emotional relationship between Avram and Yitzchak. There's midrashim of that sort. There's midrashim that Yitzchak went to Yeshiva Shoshim Va'eva. There's also midrashim about what happened to Yitzchak. But why is it Yitzchak ends up in Beersheba? When did Avram ever go to Beersheba? Avram went to Beersheba when Hagar was pregnant. Right? Avram went again in that direction when Sarah was going to have a baby. Right? After the story with Stone, he moved to Gerar. He moves out. What's Hebron? Hebron is where lots of different people from the land live, and Avram becomes part of that community. What's Beersheba? Beersheba is a truck stop. Beersheba, so people come and go, but nobody, it's all open. Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov have a double mission which are mutually exclusive. Preach to the world and raise a family. To preach to the world, you got to be right in the middle of Times Square. To raise a family, you got to be at least in Flatbush. Maybe Deal. Much better in Yerushalayim. But you understand the difference. You can't raise a family in Times Square. But how do you get to the world? So what Avram did is, when he's not raising a family, he's in Hebron, in the middle of everything. When it's time to have a kid, he moves to Beersheba, middle of nowhere. Now, Avraham has raised Yitzchak in Beersheba. They've gone to the Akedah. Now what's happened at the Akedah? Yitzchak is now on his own. Yitzchak's now got to do his own Avodah. He goes to Beersheba. Avram's ready now, Kiila retirement. He's raised his family. Now he's in Hebron. Yitzchak lives in Beersheba. And by the way, who's born in Beersheba? Yaakov and Esav. How do I know that? Because where did Yaakov leave from? Vayitzei Yitzchak mi Beersheba ve'elech Harana. But interestingly enough, when Yitzchak comes back all those years later to his father, where's his father moved to? Hebron. So Yitzchak's living in Hebron. Yaakov stays in Hebron. Why does Yaakov stay in Hebron? Because he's raised his family. And then they start to spread out. Again, we've got to follow the story through, keep our eyes open, see what's happening. One more thing I want to show you in next week's Parashah. Please take a look at Parashat Toladot. And I'm going to raise this as a question and food for thought. Parak Chav Zayin is a long story which really continues to the beginning of Parak Chav Chet, the first nine psukim. It's the story of the Brachot. The Brachot, Yaakov, Esav, right? And there's a lot of teamwork going on here. The first scene is Yitzchak and Esav, the next scene is Yaakov and Rivka, then there's Yaakov and Yitzchak, then there's Yitzchak and Esav, then there's Yitzchak and Rivka. Everything's done in twos. The whole story is in twos until the very last scene, which seems to be in all four together. We assume, and again, this is because we know the end of the story. We assume, tell me if you don't assume this, I always assume this, that from the beginning when Rivka called Yaakov over and said, Father's going to give Esav a bracha, I want you to go get the bracha, that it was clear to both of them that there was a deception going on, and that Yaakov protested because he protested, and Rivka stilled the protest and everything else, right? That's what we assume, that everybody was on, that both of them were on board with the idea that this is a deception, and Yaakov just raised the concern about it, and Rivka stilled the concern. Take a look here at, it's not so clear. Take a look, starting from Pasuk Vav. And again, the problem is we know how the story plays out, so we assume that they also know how the story played out. Of course, they don't know because they're in the story. Right? So what did I hear your father say to your brother? Go hunt stuff and bring me food the way I like it. And I'll bless you before Hashem. By the way, Yitzchak didn't say the thing Hashem. She has it in before I died. Now, what does Yitzchak intend to? What bracha does Yitzchak intend to give Esav? Is it that you're going to be the one to continue the tradition, Abraham? You're going to get the land. You're going to get Zerah. Is it something else? We don't know. Or we, being Rivka, we don't know. But Yitzchak intends to give a bracha to Esav, and to get that bracha, he told Esav to bring some food. So now, listen to what I'm telling you. Esav's a hunter, so how's he going to get food? He's going to hunt it. You're a shepherd, so what are you going to do? Go bring it from the flock. It's fairly straightforward. So far, there's no trickery. And I'll make them the way your father likes them. At this point, you take a look at the story. There is no deception going on. Right? And you'll bring the food to your father, and he'll eat it. So he'll give you a bracha before he dies. What does that mean? What is it you're picturing Rivka saying to Yaakov?
You'll also get one.
Yeah. Look, Yitzchak thinks he's going to die, whether he is or not. Turns out he's going to live a lot longer. He thinks he's going to die. Second one in a row, I think that night. He thinks he's going to die. And so he wants to give Esav a bracha. I want you to get a bracha too. So you go bring goats. I'll prepare them where your father likes, and you'll bring them in. Is there any deception here going on?
Not
it's while Esav is getting.
Yeah, what does it say instead of?
It's while Esav is getting food. So bring food while Esav is getting food.
Okay. And there's not even a mention here of hurry up fast, so you can do it before he gets in. Again, we are so accustomed to knowing how the story ends, to reading it that way, we don't necessarily read it straight. Now watch. V'yamri Yaakov el Rivka imo, hein Esav achi ish sayir v'aruchi ish chalak. Who suddenly introduces the issue of deception? Yaakov does. Yaakov says, wait a second, Esav is hairy and I've got smooth skin. What's the problem? What might happen? He'll feel me and he'll see that I'm smooth skinned and I'll be like a liar. He'll curse me instead of blessing me. So now, who has introduced the idea that we're going to be fooling Yitzchak? Looks like Yaakov is. Rivka's words don't say go instead of, or go there first, or go and lie to him. It says, I'll prepare the food also the way he likes. You go and get a bracha. And Yaakov seems to read this as being an act of deception. Yeah.
And why didn't she say it right away? What are you talking about?
Say it again?
Why didn't she say it right away? What are you talking about?
Very good question. Why doesn't Rivka turn around and say, well, what do you mean he'll feel you? What's the problem with him feeling you and knowing that you're Yaakov? I think maybe that Yaakov now started a process that Rivka picked up on. Because let's think about it. Either way, it's going to be that one person has the idea, the other person ends up going along with it. I think that Yaakov may have made this statement and suddenly Rivka picked up on something very different. What does Rivka think the bracha is? The answer is we don't know. Because what did Yitzchak say? I'm going to give you a bracha. You know what the bracha is. What are the possibilities of what this bracha is?
Wealth.
Could be a bracha of wealth and power. Could be a bracha to be the one in charge of the estate, which is what it really turns out to be. Or could be the bracha of Avraham. There's a lot of variations in there. Bracha of Avraham, meaning to continue that piece. We don't know what it is. So Rivka, by the way, is holding on to a nevuah. What is her nevuah?
That the two kids were fighting.
That they're going to fight, they're going to separate. And Rav Yavod Zahir, which could be interpreted as the elder one will enslave the younger, or the elder one will work for the younger. Evidently, Rivka read it the second way, and that Yaakov is supposed to be the one in charge. So what happens when you... Yeah, go ahead.
Also, Rivka, when she's telling Yaakov to go and find an animal, she kind of commands him a little bit strongly. Listen to my voice. I'm commanding you. So she's... It sounds like she's also expecting a confrontation or expecting an argument, because she says... So I'm kind of commanding you to do something. So she's kind of expecting Yaakov to push back, and maybe that's intimating that she knows that this is, she's creating a deception.
Could be. On the other hand, it could be that Why else come on so heavy-handed, unless she expects this confrontation? It could just be that he's saying, look, I'm Esau is doing this per our father's command. If father wanted me to do it, he would ask me to, maybe, right? And so she's putting herself in the commanding position, because Rivka to Yaakov is kind of what Yitzchak to Esau. And what happens here is that Yaakov then says, right? And one, we'll end with one little cute thing about Alai Kilat Chabani, Hashem called Ibelech Kachli. And so now it's turned into really a wholesale deception that they're working on together. But the question is really where this started, which rolls us back to a bigger question, which is what was Rivka's intent in this whole scene? Remember, Rivka starts this. Yaakov on his own doesn't start it. And the question is, what is Rivka's intent? Is Rivka's intent that Yaakov should not be cut out and he should also get a bracha? Or is Rivka's intent that Yaakov should be the only one to get the bracha? And that's a much larger question than Tashir by itself. I'm raising the question not because I have any conclusions here. I'm raising the questions because, again, when we read a story, knowing how things play out at the end, it often colors how we read the psukim themselves, and we miss a lot of the exciting ambiguity of the text, which leaves open these questions about what individuals are thinking and what they are planning, and perhaps they have to shift their plans in the middle. One little thing about Alai, which is really in the getter of cute, but something nice to end with. I heard this many, many, many years ago, is that Rivka says, Alai ki latcha b'ni. Now, by the way, that's the same word that Yaakov used. Veiti Alai klal av lo bracha. So this word Alai seems to be playing a little role. Cute, but more significantly, way down at the end, when the brothers come back without Shimon, and they say they can't go back down without Binyamin, what does Yaakov say? Yosef enenu, Shimon enenu, et Binyamin tikachu, alai hayu kulana. What does that mean, alai hayu kulana? So I want to start it again, just in the realm of cute. What did Rivka tell Yaakov? Alai kilat chabani. Literally, what does that mean? I'll take the curse on me. You can't really do that. So we showed him, say, don't worry, I'll make sure that Yitzchak pays you anyways, so including the inheritance or whatever it might be. Though Shir Shimon say, Alai actually stands for three different individuals that Yaakov had unpleasant interactions with as a result of this deception. Who are they? Esav, Lavan, and Yosef. Because how did the whole Yosef story happen? It happened because Yaakov loved Yosef because he loved Rachel. Why was Rachel not his only wife? Because of Lavan. And this whole thing happened because of this klala, because of this piece. Alai kilatcha, your curse is Alai. Right? So years later, what does Yaakov say to his sons? Yosef inenu, Shimon inenu, Binyamin tikachu, Alai hayu chulana. What is Alai hayu chulana? I was supposed to do Alai. I did Alai. Why is there another curse? In any case, just again, something cute to end with. But hopefully over the past 50 minutes, we've taken a look at a number of parshiot in Bereshit and seen how the element of surprise is something that eludes us, because we know how the story ends. We need to read with our eyes open and see what's actually playing out, where people are, why they're doing what they're doing, what we know about it, what each individual knows, and what each individual thinks is going on. And sometimes the text will give us a little help. Again, just by the use, in our case, of the difference between Eben and Ish. Okay?